Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Lauren Gibbons and Craig Mauger. Senate Minority Leader Jim Ananick will be joining us a little later on the podcast. Lauren's back from Flint. You did not bring any bottled water for us.
No, I didn't. But in one of the businesses that I was at when I wrote the story, they did have a jug of water that was labeled unleaded to make sure people knew
was
it was
at a coffee shop? Or?
Yeah, it was. It was actually the Flint Crepe Company, which, very good. I was pleased.
Did they use any of the Flint water in making their crepes?
You know, I didn't ask. Maybe I should have.
Oh, geez. You're not sick now, are you?
No.
All right. So you went to two press conferences there in Flint, Lauren, and you kind of heard two different things, didn't you? I mean, you're hearing from the administration that everything's under control, we'll get it taken care of, and then Senate Minority Leader Ananick, who we're going to have on this podcast here in a minute, is like, wait a minute, why aren't we switching over to Detroit water? We never really got an answer to that, did we?
No, there's certainly a feeling among locals in Flint and those who represent them that the state isn't necessarily doing enough to address the situation. I don't think anybody is complaining about some of the proposals that were implemented, in terms of are giving more funding to provide water filters. I mean, that I think people see as a first step, but not, it shouldn't be the end. The expediting of the project is also a good step, but I think at the end of the day, locals are very interested in making sure water is clean and safe to drink immediately, and they don't feel that the water filters are a permanent solution to that problem.
And it seems like until they get hooked up to Detroit water, Craig, then we're going to continue to kind of hear this drumbeat, because unless you get a filter on, or if it's not lead, maybe it's something else, that this is going to continue. But there doesn't seem to be any real political repercussions if this kind of drags out a little bit, as far as Snyder's concerned.
I think there will be. I think there will be political repercussions, because I think this is becoming a statewide story, and rightfully it should, because we have a large city in our state whose water is being questioned. The safetiness of that water is being questioned. And I think it's fair that people elsewhere in Michigan should take interest in this story and watch how public officials handle it. Today, I was in the state library, and I kind of reflected back on when Flint switched to its own water, and this was touted as a great public achievement for Flint and all the money they were going to save, and this water is so safe. And it's just, it's really interesting, and there are a lot of questions that are still unanswered about how things turned, how government officials handled this situation. It will be fascinating to see what kind of details come out.
When was the story that you were looking
at? It was in April 2014.
And during the April 14 edition, from what I understand, they said folks aren't going to really know a difference.
Yeah, they basically, I think there was a little bit of discussion about the water being a little harder than the Detroit water, but that was the main topic of conversation, it looked like.
Otherwise, nobody's going to know a difference at all.
Yeah, and it was touted as a great, great moment. DEQ officials were there. The mayor was there. They did like some type of ceremonial event to honor this switch to Flint's own water.
Well, Jim Ananick's going to give us a little bit of history as to how that decision came about, where it came from, and he's going to answer the question whether if this was happening in any other part of the state, would we still be talking about it? That's coming up a little later. But how did Kyle spend his Friday evening? Well, Kyle was watching the Lapeer County Tea Party Patriots have their debate of all of the Republican candidates for state representative. And plus, they actually had one Democrat who decided to show up. That was Margaret Guerrero De Luca. She was present. And so this was kind of Courser's stage to talk a little bit about himself and address, I guess, the folks in the audience and his constituents. He said that this election coming up on November 3 is a referendum on him. And this was a proclamation that at least one of the candidates, Gary Howell, took offense to and said something about during it. But after that proclamation, I think that the issues were pretty much the focus of the debate. There wasn't much attack on Courser, maybe some snide comments here or there. I thought that Courser took some jabs at how Lansing works. I thought that was probably the highlight of the event when he said, everything that people are saying here about what they're going to do in Lansing is all nice for them to say. But actually, when you go to Lansing, what happens is that you get shoved into a room, you get given a piece of paper, and it says that you have to pledge allegiance to the speaker, and you're basically going to do what leadership says, and that's that. So for all these great ideas people have, this is what's going to happen. And unless you want somebody to try and break out of that mold, which I have done, then you would vote for somebody like me. As far as other candidates there, I thought Gary Howell did pretty well. He's the Lapeer County ISD president. Jake Davison, who we all know here in town, actually embraced the insider, the Lansing insider role, which I thought was very interesting. He had a quote at a certain point in this. He said, if you want surgery, you want somebody who has done it before and someone who's had a lot of experience at it. And so he tried to segue his experience on that. I think Jan Peabody, who actually placed first in the most recent poll, didn't have the most memorable performance. She kind of, I think, whiffed when given the opportunity to name a couple sanctuary cities in this state. She said Muskegon when that was actually Detroit. Chris Tusky, I thought, did pretty well. Ian Kemp emphasized his experience in state government or in county government, for whatever that's worth. And for the folks who I'd never really seen or heard of before, I thought this Russell Adams gentleman was very well-spoken, very comfortable in speaking to the group, and I thought represented his positions on the issues pretty well. What did you think? What do you think of this here, Craig, that this race in the 82nd district is a referendum on Todd Corser? Is that a good way to describe this race?
I think so. I mean, the issue is that there are so many other candidates in the race that it's going to muddy the water a little bit of that referendum issue. But we're having this election because of Todd Corser's actions in office. We're having this election because of things Todd Corser did. So it's right that this is a referendum on him. I think it's interesting. You know, you talked about some of these candidates being newcomers and not knowing a lot about them. I think that's probably why Peabody's in the front right now. I mean, this is a six-week election cycle, basically. That's not enough time if you're not well-known to get your name out there. It's just not enough time. In normal House elections, people start trying to get their name out there about a year out if they're not well-known. And that's what some of these people are up against. Jan Peabody ran a pretty active campaign just last year, so she's in a good position from there.
Exactly. And even in this Tea Party event, I think when I was on, the most I ever saw on with me was about 35 folks who were watching it live stream. And then just looking at the crowd, you know, if you had a few dozen people in there and you figure most of those folks were spouses or supporters of a particular candidate. So how many undecideds were actually in that crowd?
Mm-hmm. And then you've got this fragmented Republican Party in Lapeer County where the Lapeer Tea Party, I don't think, usually backs Corser. They've feuded in the past. The Lapeer County Republican Party, someone described it to me as being in tatters because you've got all these different factions and elements. And all of that's going to play into this race. To see who could potentially win this, what's going to be a jump ball in many ways.
That was our update. We've got another debate coming up this week, this one in Allegan County.
Yeah, I think there's going to be three debates coming up in Allegan County where the race is a little easier to analyze because basically you have Cindy Gamrat, who's trying to win back her seat, and you've got Jim Story and Mary Whiteford, who are the two other kind of top-tier candidates there.
Talking about other House members here, the Freedom Fund put out a press release today, and I want to talk about this, Craig, because we haven't written much about this, about Representative Alberta Tinsley Tlaibi. The Freedom Fund is asking that she be removed from her House committee assignments after being accused of accepting bribes and implicated last week in a federal corruption probe. I don't know if she's actually been formally accused by anybody, and I think that's really the difference here, right?
Well, she hasn't yet been charged with the crime, as all the media stories have detailed, and these kind of these veiled allegations and some of these facts of the benefits that she may have taken while she was serving in that local government position have been out there for a while. I think when Speaker Cotter was asked about this last week, he said, yeah, I've known about this for about a year. So, I mean, it's kind of because of the legal developments last week with the sentencing, this is being put back into the forefront. And I think it's also being put into the forefront because we just had a lawmaker get expelled. So now anytime anyone does anything that's questionable, it's going to be this drumbeat. Should they be expelled or not?
She has been investigated now for a year now. And in that regard, not really much has changed here. The only thing that's changed that is that her former chief of staff, George Stanton, pleaded guilty to accepting bribes, and federal prosecutors, you know, basically won that case. Whether anything happens with her, we don't know yet. And I'm sure if she were to be charged with something, the situation would change. And it's very also possible that the investigation leads nowhere and we never hear from it again. So that's just something we got to keep our eyes on. Okay, with that, we'll head over to our interview now with Jim Anik.
Thanks for joining us this morning. Thanks for having me.
We've had 48 hours since your last press conference on the Flint water situation. Give us an update. Has there been anything that has changed over the weekend?
You know, on Saturday, United Way pulled together some volunteers and other folks to distribute filters for home faucets, and that went really well from 10 to 5. Some of us got together yesterday, and we're meeting about how we're going to now deal with the schools short-term and more longer-term, how we're going to address that, whether it's there's certain water faucets you can put in place that have lead filters in them and that you can use for, you know, just drinking, but also for filling up bottled water. Working with the Flint School and others to put those in place, but also trying to figure out a way to make sure we can give them some temporary relief. Obviously a pretty big issue, probably one of the biggest we'll have to deal with, and in 2015, something that we shouldn't have to deal with, unfortunately, in the sense of lack of urgency that I've received from many departments of state government is really alarming and unfortunate. Something that I'm not going to accept.
Well, and we're going to talk about that here in a second, but just to give our listeners some background, how did this happen in the first place where we changed from Detroit water to Flint water? How was that decision made? Give us some background on that.
Yeah, Flint has been on the Detroit Water and Sewer Authority since 1968, and the county drain commissioner had been trying to put in place what they call the Kiragandhi Water Authority, which is a number of communities from Port Huron to Genesee County that would all participate in a sort of an authority to get raw water from Port Huron and then treat it for each community. The benefit of raw water is, from an economic development standpoint, a lot of manufacturing and things like that need raw water. It was an economic development tool. It also assures that we have clean water that we can treat and get to our citizens and control our own destiny, right? I mean, Detroit was raising our rates pretty much every year. We had no real say in that. We were the largest customer to DWSD for a long period of time, and the city council voted to go forward with joining the KWA, which is the Kiragandhi Water Authority, and Detroit, I believe there was some discussions back and forth. You know, if you're not going to stay on, then we're going to cut you off at the end of this contract, yada, yada, yada. But the decision was made by the emergency manager in Flint to leave the Detroit water system, which was also run by emergency manager at the time. And what happened was, I'm finding more out about water than I ever thought I would ever need to know, as you can imagine. But
I'm sure.
no matter what source of water, whether it's Lake Huron water like Detroit has or Flint River water, there's some corrosiveness in the water, and you need to sort of put an anti-corrosive inhibitor in place to help take down some of to help get the pH levels where they need to be. Flint did not put an anti-corrosion control inhibitor in place, so the DEQ, which is the job to regulate, to make sure that every citizen has safe drinking water, failed in their regulatory responsibility to make sure that Flint did this. So Flint basically treated the water. So in the treatment plant, the tests are fine because the water is coming in raw, they're treating it, and then it's going out. And the problem we have is that the lead service lines from the mains to the homes, because of so many of the homes were being built, you know, obviously an older city, tens of thousands of homes were built with lead service lines. The water sits there and the lines are not being used. And because it's so corrosive and because there's no corrosive control inhibitor in place, which is just basically phosphate, it sounds much more complicated than it is, the phosphate would coat the wall lead pipes and keep it from leaking into the water. Well, the water was so corrosive, much more so than Detroit, 19 times more corrosive than Detroit, it leaks the water out, and now we're seeing citywide a doubling of elevated levels of blood, in certain zip codes, tripling, if not more. Any exposure to lead is too much, but when you have tripling and sometimes quadrupling of lead levels, it's just completely unacceptable, and this needs to be addressed. And there was one thing that changed. The common denominator is the water source, right? So everything else has stayed the same. We haven't added any lead service lines, obviously. You know, there's no one's using lead paint anymore, so there's no increase in lead exposure other than the water source. So the thing for many of us is to switch over back to Detroit.
Well, let's talk about going back to the decision to move from Detroit to Flint River water. From my understanding, that was a community outreach, too, that there was a lot of public officials who wanted to make that move. Is that accurate to say?
What I've heard a number of people say, because I was in the legislature at the time. I wasn't in the local government, that it was a cost measure, and that if they were assured that the water would be just as safe, some people thought it made sense. You know, the emergency manager did make the decision, and some folks have said, well, the city council voted. I mean, when emergency managers are in place, you can't turn a light bulb on. A light switch on without the emergency manager telling you it's okay. That's just
right.
The way it goes. So,
were you in the city council at the time, though?
No, I was not.
Oh, okay.
There was talk when I was on city council about switching over to Flint River Water, and I was on the Flint Watershed Coalition, and folks in the Watershed Coalition assured me that it was not a good idea for capacity reasons. So I was never a supporter of it. But I was in Lansing at the time when the decision was made.
Now, we see these pictures on the newspaper about folks holding up like orange water and yellow water. Had this been going on for some time? How come it needed a study from Hurley and Virginia Tech before this really reached a boiling point?
Well, I mean, a lot of us, Representative Neely, Representative Phelps, and I in particular were working on it because we initially were told by experts, right? I mean, the DEQ are the experts. The City of Flint Department of Public Works are supposed to hire experts. So we were told that it was just an E. coli issue. It was an E. coli breakout, which people had to boil their water. Representative Neely and I and Phelps donated water at the time. You know, then there was an issue with PTHM, which is basically a chlorine that helps treat the water. There was elevated levels of that, which, you know, can cause cancer. So we worked with the administration to get money for a charcoal filter. But there was never any discussion of lead. It was just smell, discoloration, PTHM, all things that are serious and all things that we were trying to help the city resolve. And then when Dr. Mark Edwards came out with a study about elevated levels of lead, and then the Hurley doctors and the pediatricians came together and said, one, we're seeing it in our patients, and we're also seeing it in the numbers, it became an epidemic or a crisis that we all need to be working on.
Now, what is your understanding on the logistics about switching Flint water back to Detroit? Is that possible, and how quickly could that realistically be done?
Well, it's no question it's possible. You know, I spoke to folks in Detroit. They've assured me that we can do it in the short term or the long term. And the county still owns the pipe. There's a lot of discussion about this pipe being sold. It was sold from the city to the county. The county still gets Detroit water. So logistically, I think the way that would be done, I'm not an expert at this, and this is why I've called publicly and in letters that we need to have an emergency response professional. As if there was a tornado or a natural disaster that happened, we need to have somebody on the ground, you know, figuring out logistics. So, you know, a lot of the stuff we're trying to do sort of on a shoestring. So basically, the amount of water that Flint needs, Detroit would just sell that to Genesee County. Genesee County would then transfer it through a sale, obviously, to Flint. So to me, it does not seem like it would be something that is that complicated. You know, it could take some time. And switching back to Detroit will then change the water. So it will take a while before it's completely up to the standards we need it to be. So it's not like this is going to be overnight. The quicker the city and the state moves towards making this happen, the quicker we can have a secure, safe drinking water source again.
If
the longer people delay, it's compounding the problem.
Senator, if this were happening right now in, let's say, West Bloomfield or Birmingham, do you think we'd still be talking about it?
No, I mean, it would have been resolved a long time ago. There's this saying about people in Flint, and I've lived there my whole life, about we're resilient. But at what point in time is it acceptable that we have to continue to be resilient over things that in the 21st century, in the most advanced country in the world, surrounded by the freshest water in the world, that we have to have questions about whether or not we're poisoning our kids? It's just unacceptable to me.
Then why do you think that there seems to be a delayed reaction in getting Flint back on the Detroit water?
You know, I've heard a lot about cost. And to me, a cost-benefit analysis that has cost on one side and brain damage for kids on the other is just incomprehensible. So to me, it's you get it fixed, we figure out the finances later. It's just, it was a decision made by the emergency manager. The city council voted to go back to Detroit about 8 months ago or 6 months ago. And the emergency manager said it was irresponsible. They were, you know, basically said everything in the book about how bad of a decision that was. If we'd have done it then, there's a good chance we wouldn't be in the problem we're in right now. And it shows you one of the glaring failures of the emergency manager law. Obviously, they have total control and they can do a lot of changes that need to be made. But when they leave, there's no accountability. And it's a big problem, and we need to switch over as quickly as possible.
So basically, because Flint is a poor city, that's why they're still in the situation.
You know, it's hard for me to speculate, but I can tell you that's the way it feels. You know, these are just poor folks. You know, well, we'll get to it when we get to it. I mean, that's, you know, the outrage needs to come from everybody. You know, the citizens are outraged and need to be more so. And I think the Department of Environmental Quality, the Department of Health and Human Services, this is a public health epidemic. It needs to be resolved. This is not something that this isn't something that's, you know, well, it smells funny. This is an epidemic. And every day we're not doing this, we're exposing children and citizens to more lead. It's just not acceptable.
Where is the legal culpability here? Is it with the emergency manager? Is it with the state? I mean, at some point, somebody's going to have to file something.
I think those are legitimate questions and questions that I can say I will be asking and I'll be looking for answers to. But I'm so focused right now in getting people the temporary relief they need and then switching the source that I basically don't even, I mean, I think about it. It's important to me. But the most important thing right now is to get people back to a source of water that's safe and secure. And, you know, that's sort of something that it's not going to go away and it shouldn't, but it needs to be sort of secondary
okay.
in my mind.
Real quickly here, just a couple other questions on some different topics. Senator Virgil Smith, has he been excluded from Senate Democratic Caucus meetings?
No, he's not.
We noticed him sitting on the floor, though, by himself when you all are in the back room there.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a decision he's made.
But if he wanted to hop in the caucus meetings, you guys wouldn't kick him out?
We haven't had that decision come up. I mean, so it's hard to say. I mean, I don't think we would. No, I mean, his actions are unexcusable. And, you know, obviously he's going through a legal case to deal with that right now. But I think that's what his focus should be. And I think that's the decision he's made as well.
And then lastly, Dan Kildee, how do you think he would be as a governor of this state?
I think he'd be a great governor. I hope he really takes a serious look at it. I think he's been a strong advocate for Michigan, not just the 5th District in Washington. He's a very competent county treasurer, you know, created a land bank law, helps. The vast majority of blight that's been removed in the state has come through his efforts. You know, I don't know if he's going to do it or not, but I hope he takes a real serious look at it.
Have you ever thought of going to Washington?
You know, I took a trip there when I was in high school, and it was kind of fun. So, you know, I'm just focused on trying to build a strong Senate Democratic caucus and now and in the future. And, you know, I'll consider those things if that decision's made by him, but it's not something I'm focused on right now.
Senate Minority Leader Jim Ananick, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Kyle. I appreciate it.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Lauren and Craig for bringing his stew up here. It smelled very nice. Didn't you have any more?
No, this is all I had.
That's all you had left?
This stew is a metaphor for the road conversations, you know.
It's an empty bowl.
But it was before I ate it. I mean, that's all you need to know. I was bringing it up here so we could, if we're going to talk about roads.
That we could stew about it?
Yes, their stewing is continuing in the capital about roads.
But it's not stew. It's not soup yet. It's just stew.
I know, I should have brought soup, but I didn't have soup.
But it's not soup yet.
Maybe we're getting close.
That's why it's stewed, because we're still stewing about it. It's not soup.
Oh, but as you pointed out, the bowl is empty.
Read into that guys.
I think it's half full.
Half full? There's hardly a bite in there. Maybe if you get a rubber scraper in there, you can get one bite.
Maybe like two chunks left in there. Sorry, Craig.
All right, well, there's an analogy in there somewhere, folks. It's up to you to figure it out.
Still
until next week, I'm Kyle Nguyen. Take care.